Nation's second great awakening. We call the first great awakening to get our minds back together. First great awakening, the two men we think of are roughly 1700 and following. Who are the two men of the first great awakening? Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards. The second great awakening began by this time the frontier had moved into the Ohio Valley, Midwest, what we call it. They moved back to the east, and then the east earning some leadership, eastern colonies, for the continuing revival in the west. The characteristic phenomenon of the second great awakening was the Cane meeting, the Cane Ridge meeting being the greatest of them. We talked about the effect that this had on creating this American religious phenomenon called revivalism. Perhaps one of the greatest of these, we see Protestantism at its peak in this century in America. The famous revivalist Charles Finney. Now, Finney was a Methodist. Had become the greatest body, but Finney was a Presbyterian who grew up with the Edwardian mind. Here's what went on: the old guard Presbyterian, the old time Calvinistic Presbyterian, said, "You are not evangelistic." Edwards did what modern Calvinists do. He was evangelistic anyway, saying that God would pick the time and the place for the sinner to be converted. Finney broke with the Edwardian model and went even further and acted like a Methodist, in that he offered salvation to everyone and said, you have a revival. A revival is not a miracle. You have a revival if you follow certain laws. And Finney is the one who produced the idea that if you do certain things, you'll have certain results, cause and effect. And he wrote up the laws governing revival. He called them the new measures, the protracted meeting, and it was Finney who created, on page 146, it was Finney who created the anxious seat, later called the mourner's bench, known today as the altar. Heard an altar call? Okay. Originally, it was the anxious seat or the mourner's bench. Now, in the groups who use it, they call it the altar. The altar. Now, I put this citation in Finney. It's very interesting. He's the man who invented the altar, as it were. Here's what he says. Now, I give you the source. If you say to him, that is the awakened sinner, he's a Calvinist, There is the anxious seat. Come and avow your determination to be on the Lord's side. If he is not willing to do so small a thing as that, then he's not willing to do anything. And there he is brought out before his own conscience. It uncovers the delusion of the human heart and prevents a great many spurious conversions by showing those who might otherwise imagine themselves willing to do anything for Christ, that in fact they want to do nothing. And he said, if you have an invitation and you have them come to the anxious seat and there pray, for to be saved. Finney was quite a likable fellow, very good humor, in the preaching of Finney. Finney was the greatest evangelist. Preached against social ills as well as spiritual. He preached against slavery. A great influence, by the way, against slavery. He was oratorical, pushed for a specific decision. Concerning results, a biographer states, during a service in which Charles Grandison Finney, was preaching, a man who brought a pistol to church with him to kill Finney tumbled from his seat crying, I am sinking into hell. You like that? In Rochester, New York, nearly the entire bar, that means the lawyers, the city was converted. Think about that, converting a bunch of lawyers, that takes some doing. 40 lawyers went into the ministry following Finney's efforts in that city. Can you believe that? 40 of them. After hearing Finney, a young and prosperous distiller in Auburn went to his quite effective. because he found that the inquirers, his huge hippodrome services, his huge, this mass meetings that Billy Graham has, because he found this, let me just say this to you, I'll teach you something here. You run studies on this. I do not support Billy Graham for two reasons. I don't support his theology. I respect Billy Graham, and I think he does a lot of good in some way. I respect his theology. I mean, I respect his sincerity. I don't view this theology, and so I don't support him. But another reason I don't support Billy Graham is I do not support any mass evangelists, even ours. The reason is poor, it's a matter of stewardship. It's a waste. By that I mean, if you just simply computed what it costs to put on, to carry on mass evangelism, what it costs. And if you, and these studies are all in, even Billy Graham's outfit is done, they were surprised, they still publish it. But if you go back, take all those decisions that people who were not Christians and who came forward in the meeting to become Christians, you realize that those who come forward at Billy Graham's meeting, about a third of them are workers. You know, they're stationed all throughout the stadium, and then when the invitation they get up and start moving down, so there's always somebody moving from all over the stadium. Those are assigned workers, did you know that? And most of those who come are already members of the church. Very few people come forward in those services who are not already members of a church somewhere. And as we simply say, an alien sinner, a non-Christian. But you take the, you compute the cost of those, you take the cost of carrying on, of doing evangelism that way. And you study, for instance, take the number of those who came forward and said in Billy Graham meeting and in Moody's meetings as well, who are not Christians, and see how many are still Christians 6 months to a year later. You'll find with Billy Graham, that's a, it costs $100,000 to $150,000 per convert. And that's simply, and no matter who does it, it is simply a not intent. Now, Billy Graham has had some spectacular, some notable converts, but you figure the cost of doing it that way. It is the least efficient way of evangelism. The most efficient way is the local church. And for what it costs to win one soul in mass evangelism, you can support a missionary for a year. You could build a pretty good sized church building and be part of a church building for what it costs to win one soul. So I don't, you understand what I'm saying? So I don't support it no matter what doctrine is taught, because I think it is poor stewardship. And Moody found this out. Billy Graham, their own organization that published a statistic. For instance, he held a big campaign in one major city. Remember this, it wasn't Billy Graham. Big program that was called I Found It? The big interdenominational mass evangelism was when all these thousands of people, this was back about the time I came down here, the late mid-70s. And so they did this and had big meetings and big lot of decisions and the whole big thing. That was a big success. So they went back and studied. And they found in some major, first they went back to Seattle. They had this big mass meetings and all these decisions in Seattle. They went back and to see how many were there. And in some city, I think it was Seattle, didn't find anybody. It was less than like a half of 1% of those who came forward were still serving the Lord, were active in any kind of church a year later or 6 months later. They found that the results were almost nil. And so what I'm trying to teach is that Moody discovered this. Moody, who was the prototype in Billy Graham and the modern mass evangelist, he checked into it and found that he was getting big crowds and a lot of decisions, but very few small results. A long-term basis. So, the last part of Moody's life, Moody turned away from, and Moody's a very practical man, Moody turned away from mass evangelism to education. He started schools, the great Moody Bible Institute, which has been a powerful school over the years in Chicago. It's testimony to the fact that he wanted to do something that was lasting, and so while he didn't get rid of mass evangelism, he turns the focus of his ministry from mass evangelism to schools.
Look here, he founded the Northfield Seminary for Girls, Mount Hermon School for Boys, the Bible Institute of Chicago. It is now Moody Bible Institute, founded in 1889. Any questions on that? Gus's hands.
What
is
meetings like this with proper follow-up? It still doesn't work. Even if you get people in, try to get people involved in churches, it still doesn't work.
Because what happens is you got a emotional situation. It's spectacular. Most people there are already Christians. If you come in, you hear one sermon. The most efficient way of winning souls is the local church. And that's what it's done anyway. That's why I say my I do not support mass evangelism on principle. It's on principle stewardship. I say no matter what is preached. And I've been involved with our church on big area meetings and just even revival meetings. Evangelistically speaking, aren't much good for evangelism anymore. Time was when they were. The way to do evangelism is the local worker, the local people. They need to prize the people that they know. That's how it's done. It's the local church. Always come back to that.
Is Moody identified with Baptist or not?
Yes. He was belief only, interdenominational. Mainly he was Calvinistic interdenominational. Well, y'all think about that, but let me just say that where the action is, it's not in the what I call Christian celebrities. That's not where the action is. It's not in the Bible college. The action is in the local church. That's where the kingdom work is at, the local church. Not here, in the local church. That's the kingdom. You understand? That's where it either happens or doesn't happen. Not on television, not the mass evangelistic campaign. Unless Tammy's on there.
Oh.
Then you really get something back.
If she cries or something.
Oh, you had to bring that up. Look at the bottom of page 148. Let's move on. Summing up, this is the 19th century up to 1870. In the early days, the desire to return to Christian roots combined with the desire to move with the prevailing spirit in 19th century American culture helped shape a distinctive evangelical theology. There was a desire to look back, and the Campbell Stone movement was a part of a desire to look back to the roots. There was a desire to move with the time. Many groups, such as the Lutherans and Presbyterians, even some branches of the Episcopalians adopt more evangelistic revival methods. It was full of optimism. Things were going. Those were the glory days. They've been that great since. Look at from 1870 to 1930, there was if you look at Protestants in America, the general setting. Well, America stopped being a rural society and gradually became an urban society. There was an advance in technology, travel, America became a world power. Evolution rose in the mid-19th century to challenge American thought. Darwinism, social Darwinism changed the way things work. The German scientific method of studying the Bible came into the church. As you know, it split us with our movement. There was immigration changed values in American life. The great industries depersonalized people. There was a rise in materialism. Very hard to be spiritual and wealthy at the same time. You know that, don't we? Don't know that either. I don't know where I'm at. I'll find out by experience sometime, but I'll think I will. But America became very materialistic. This is a great transition. Liberalism came into the great Protestant seminaries. I'll give you an example of this modern. Originally it was called modernism, later it was called liberalism.
And as liberalism came in, we've talked about this enough, I don't have to go over that, there arose men in Protestantism to defend the faith. I list some of these. John Miley was a noted Methodist who wrote his Systematic Theology, and I list the arguments that he gave for traditional conservative religion. Edward Young Mullins, the notable Southern Baptist, he wrote the book, Why is Christianity True? And he argues on the grounds I outlined there. You probably heard of Charles Haas, noted Presbyterianist. What is Darwinism? The Church Fights Back. B.B. Warfield and J. Gresham Machen. This was called the Princeton Triumvirate. These three men at Princeton, this period. You see the years there. The Princeton Triumvirate, Hodge, Warfield, and Machen. I list their works. They gave the liberals all they could handle. And there arose out of this controversy between conservative Christianity and modernism, or what is later called liberalism, biblical thought versus German thought, there arose what we call fundamentalism. I feel very important in this class to teach you what fundamentalism is. It's an important element today. The most noteworthy response to liberalism was that offered by a team of evangelicals working in concert between 1910 and 1915, the Testimony Publishing Company, located on the grounds of Moody Bible Institute. Moody has been very influential in this. Produced 12 booklets now this set was called The Fundamentals. This is where the word came in, The Fundamentals of the Faith. It was financed by the union, by the owners of the Union Oil Company. You see right on page 150? And the oil company paid to have these sent out. That is, one of the reasons these were so influential is that they were published, this company, they were privately published, and they sent them out free by the thousands. They were sent without charge to pastors, evangelists, missionaries, theological professors, and so forth. A few of the articles were lightweight and useless. The bulk of the nearly 100 articles in this series of booklets, The Fundamentals, the majority were met the liberal challenge head on. They were substantial, we would say. When the word fundamentalist became the party label for an anti-intellectual and intolerant approach to orthodoxy, many refused to theology get into fundamentals. What I'm saying is that the term fundamentalist came from this series of books because the series was titled The Fundamentals. Okay? So, listen to me. Anybody, therefore, people who stood against liberalism, German theology, came to say, well, I subscribe to the theology in the fundamentals, okay? In this universally read set of books. Therefore, somebody who was conservative was someone who followed the fundamentals and was what? A fundamentalist. Now that's where the term came from. Did you know that? You learned something this morning. That's where the term. Originally, it meant refer. Later, fundamentalist came to be used, as it is used today, to mean by the public and in the media, to mean an ignorant conservative, a closed fundamentalist today. When you see fundamentalist in the newspaper, it means a closed-minded Bible thumper. And many fundamentalists have been closed-minded Bible thumpers. Many fundamentalists today are closed-minded, half-educated Bible thumpers. Turn the radio on, you get Oliver B. Green. You've heard this, that's not what I'm thinking about. You've heard of Oliver B. Green? He's dead now. He's a half-educated, Bible-thumping ignoramus. Okay, but the term, so many rejected, but the term, but the fundamentals, in the main, were not ignorant, they were not light, they were very substantial. They dealt very legitimately and convincingly with the issue. You understand? So it started out being a very respectable term. It's come to mean something other. Now we're going to see there's been a turn in that back the other way now. Fundamentalism is kind of is going to loop. Whereas before, that is, there are many fundamentalists now who operate at the level of the original fundamentals. For instance, you take Jerry Falwell, who calls himself a fundamentalist, and who is a fundamentalist, and his Liberty University. You look at their catalog, well, you cannot accuse them of being anti-academic, you know, taking cheap shots, being uninformed. He has put together a first-rate school with top men, top scholars, because he's had the money to do that. It's a fundamentalist. Well, that's more in the spirit of the original fundamentals. So you have men like fundamentalists like Oliver B. Green, these guys who are just sitting here ranting Bible thumpers. But you have others now who call themselves fundamentalists who are anything but that. Well, I don't agree with Falwell's theology, but you can't accuse him, you know, putting together a third-rate English Bible Institute. Now, in this high water mark, and therefore because there were people in all the major churches, Protestant churches, there arose an interdenominational fundamentalist movement. And you understand the fundamentalist is an interdenominational term. You can have a fundamentalist Presbyterian, there are fundamentalist Baptists, fundamentalist Methodists. It is not a church, it's an interdenominational designation. The high water mark, fundamentalism, reached its apex in the decade during and after World War I. A huge World Bible Conference was held in 1919 in Philadelphia, led to the organization of the World Christian Fundamentals Association. And it was under the pressure of these that the anti-evolution laws got passed. You know that? Which have been largely taken off the books now. But some of the anti-evolution books, the laws were put on the books, Tennessee, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Texas, as the result of the pressure of the fundamentalists. Look at the later history of the fundamentalists. Finally, this great interdenominational association broke up. They lost their drive, but they left behind what is today still a strong influence within Protestantism. Now, I myself do not admit to the term fundamentalist because, as it's popularly understood, but the public understands fundamentalist to mean a half-educated Bible thumper. If I have to choose between the two terms, between fundamentalist and evangelical, I prefer the term evangelical because it means conservative yet not closed-minded. I prefer the term Christian. That is, I don't ever, probably that's why I am Christian.
Premillennial return of Jesus. No, not necessarily. No. You see,
There are two grounds upon which I do not, there are two reasons why I do not accept for myself the term fundamentalist. One is, I'm not a premillennialist. I don't accept the idea that if you believe the Bible, then you're a premillennialist. I believe the inerrancy of Scripture, I'm not a premillennialist. Secondly, the second reason why I do not admit to the term fundamentalist, the label fundamentalist, is, and I've already said that, most fundamentalists are ignorant Bible thumpers. Creation was in 4004 B.C. in September, you know, and...
It wasn't.
But although I recognize, I am glad, I rejoice in the fact that within fundamentalism there is a genuine turn to scholarship. But for those two reasons, one, I'm not a premillennialist. Number two, too often, still for me, the term designates the closed-minded fellow, then I do not admit to being a fundamentalist. You see, fundamentalism, look at the character and tone of fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is anti-scholarship. Now listen to me, the original fundamentals were not anti-scholarship, the original books. Fundamentalism became anti-scholarship. It is in many phases of it, many fundamentalists are returning to scholarship. But still, that is a characteristic of it across the boards in the main. That is, most fundamentalists are anti-scholarship. Now, let me say that this is a part of the Americanization of Protestantism. Remember, I've taught you how that the man created an anti-intellectual mood in all conservative churches, including ours. Still today, you're going to find people who look down upon you if you've got a college degree. If you've got a PhD, you're totally untrustworthy. You're a target for snipers. Now, we're getting away from that. You understand? We're getting away from that. But that is, do you realize that when I started undergraduate school, as far as I know, there were only three men with PhDs teaching in all of our schools. And they kept it, and they wouldn't put their diploma on the wall. Why? Because they weren't trusted. There's that two things, this general deification of the common man and the fact that so many scholars had led the movement into liberalism before. They were scared of it. Okay. The character of or tone of fundamentalism, anti-scholarship, hyper-literalistic hermeneutics, that makes them premillennial. We believe the Bible what it says. You know, hyper-literalistic hermeneutics, evangelistic outreach, which we would agree with, and isolationism. That is, fundamentalists within the churches tend to be isolate themselves. For instance, you take the Independent Baptist movement. Jerry Falwell is an Independent Baptist. That is, he's associated with what the fundamentalists broke away from the Southern Baptists, from the Independent Baptists. Some of them did. Because some Southern Baptists are fundamentalists. I'm simply saying that fundamentalists tend to be isolationists. They often will go off and start their own group, do their own thing, and not answer to any denomination, any brotherhood, just be their own kingdom. Now, the second thing is dispensationalism, and I deal with this in eschatology in detail. Let me give you the outline of it here. You need to know what this is. It's very important for us today, dispensationalism. So this is an overlap with eschatology. Dispensationalism began with modern dispensation with John Nelson Darby and the Plymouth Brethren. They picked up on a futurist approach to scripture, which really came from the Jesuits, believe it or not, only in Rivera. You get that in eschatology. But it was these Darby with the Plymouth Brethren began to talk about God not having, God has two people, not one people. God does not have one people, the church. He has two peoples, the church and national Israel. And God's primary redemptive, the messianic plan deals primarily, listen to me, primarily with national Israel, secondarily with the church. and that the kingdom was to be a Jewish world empire.
Now, today, Dwight Pentecost, if he's still alive or not,
and John Valverde. John Valverde, the president, current president of Dallas Theological Seminary, is a leading dispensationalist. They set their own school. Hal Lindsey graduated from Dallas Theological Seminary. Now, I'll list you the principles of dispensationalism, or I talk about that, and the significance of the term, where the term came from. You could read that. What is the, top of page 152, what is the influence of dispensationalism? Well, it's very strong in Baptist churches, especially independent Baptists. That if you find a Southern Baptist church, it may or may not be dispensationalist. But if you find an independent Baptist church, you can bet your hat it's dispensationalist. The interesting thing is, about the right things, he knows what he's doing. Jerry Falwell is no fool. See, he himself is a dispensationalist, and he's anti-charismatic, but he never says so on his TV. You never hear him say a word about the tongues movement, and you never hear him say a word about dispensationalism. I never heard him say a thing about dispensationalism. A few oblique references. Why? Because, you see, he would lose support. That is, he represents sort of fundamentalists, but he does not deal with the issues that divide fundamentalists. That is, if he came out against tongues, he would lose a huge amount of support. You know that, don't you? He knows that. Now, whether he teaches it privately in the church, I don't know. Saying is wrong about this. I'm simply, this is his method, that he stands for those issues that make the liberals mad and the secular humanists mad, but he downplays the issues that divides. In other words, he speaks lightly about the issues that divide secular humanists from believers, but he stays away from those issues that divide believer from believer in his public ministry anyway. You understand that? Because, and I think I'm not saying I disagree with him, I think he's pretty smart. Why? Because, you see, it enables him to do battle where he thinks the battle must be done. The primary battle is between the believers and secular humanism, against abortion and, you know, that kind of evolution. And he battles very effectively. Kissinger was the Antichrist, as was Mussolini. one is the often extravagant, imaginative, silly, or all. Because dispensationalists tend to be enthusiastic about their views and tend to equate it with fidelity to Scripture. If you don't agree with me, you just don't believe the Bible, you see. Dispensationalism has a well-deserved reputation for divisiveness. By the way, it has divided our brotherhood among the non-Islamic brethren, not our brotherhood, but divided the Restoration Movement. One other thing, you know, we in the independent Christian churches, we are pretty united. That is, we, within the independent Christian churches, you have we have many dispensations, but they're not a separate from Christian church. Many premillennial, always have had premillennials, but we do not have a premillennial Christian church, you understand? Whereas we have both points of view in our brotherhood, we have not divided over it, and I'm glad we have. I think we should not divide over it. But our honest brethren have divided over it. It's a definite premillennial fellowship that does not recognize anybody else as the church. We don't believe the Bible. So, and it has divided many Protestant groups. It is very divisive. What is the character of dispensationalism? Dispensationalism is a recent minority view that represents a major departure from Protestant theological heritage, from the Protestant theological heritage. While it is a very visible view and a growing view, in the church at large, and if you look at scholarship at large, it's a minority view. Okay, we'll take our, let's take our break now. The next hour, we're going to talk about the Holiness Movement. And,